good afternoon, good afternoon, good afternoon. It is a Monday, December the 18th, 2017. 17 minutes past the hour, and oh my goodness, we are just 7 days away from Christmas. It has snuck up on everybody out there. So I hope you are getting your shopping done. Do want to get some housekeeping out of the way here before I introduce our first guest on the program. Coming up in hour two today, we're going to be joined by a legendary comedian, if you remember her. She released a lot of albums in the 50s, 60s, and even into the 70s. Rusty Warren, she has just released her new autobiography. You're not going to want to miss that. Rusty Warren live on this program next hour. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to be joined by Pat Koch at 12:15. Now, Pat is the head elf, let's put it that way, in Santa Claus, Indiana. Because if you mail your letters to Santa Claus in Santa Claus, Indiana, Pat and her band of merry elves will make sure that letter gets to Santa Claus. And remember, you do still have time to get your letter to Santa Claus. It's Santa Claus, P.O. Box 1, Santa Claus, Indiana, 47579. And also tomorrow on the program, legendary comedian Checky Green, who's always funny and will have a lot of fun in the holiday spirit. Today, coming up at 2:10 to 4 p.m. today, a new program here on WWGH Radio, The Rick Rant Show. So you won't want to miss that. Rick Rants today, 2:10 to 4 p.m. And the WWGH Christmas special tomorrow night, 6:10 to 8 p.m. I will host that. We'll have the whole gang in here. Musical performances by Paul and Glenna Savage, the Lasekni Brothers. You will hear the debut of the Fruitcake song, Christmas Candy, tomorrow night, 6:10 until 8 p.m. Now, today, one of my favorite people is on, and who do you invite on in the holiday time but one of your favorite people? She is best known for her stint on TV's The McLaughlin Group. It was always fun to watch her there on Friday evenings. That's when it was on in this area. She wrote for Newsweek. She is currently with The Daily Beast, and when we want to find out what's going on in Washington, and oh boy, there's always something going on in Washington these days, we turn to our friend Eleanor Clift. Eleanor, how are you?
I'm good, thank you, and I hope you are as well, approaching this holiday season.
Are you ready for the holiday, Eleanor?
I'm flying out to Los Angeles on Wednesday. My oldest son lives in Ventura, which is where the fires have been. So he and his family were evacuated, but they're back home. He says the air quality is rated hazardous, and he's got surgical masks for everybody. So anyway, he said rather fatalistically that the trip will be all the more interesting because he can show us all the devastation. So it's going to be a wake-up call, I think, about the planet. And Governor Jerry Brown has told the citizens of California that this is the new normal. They haven't had a drop of rain in 3 months, and the dryness has really contributed to the fires.
You know, Jerry Brown, he is an interesting political figure, had this big boom in the 70s and 80s, and everybody was urging him to run for president. Bill Clinton kind of overshadowed him. He disappeared. And now here he is again. What do you make of Jerry Brown's life?
He's a very good governor. He has worked to get enough Republicans aboard in the legislature to have a tax structure that makes sense and to really confront the problems in the state. There's been some clamor for him to run for president again the last time and now this time, but he's now well into his 70s, so that's not realistic. But he's been an excellent public servant, and he learned a lot from his earlier two terms, which were successful then in their own way, but he mostly got attention for his kind of mystical quality, and he was dating the singer Linda Ronstadt and all of that, and so he kind of had a dreamy quality. Now, he's a very hard-nosed realist this second time around, and we could use more public servants like him.
Eleanor, just one more question about the holiday before we get into the politics. Are you a big gift giver? What's your favorite part of the holiday?
In my family, we do a secret Santa. So everybody, we draw names out of a hat, and everybody is responsible for a gift for one other person. So we try to keep a lid on the gift giving. I think that can get out of hand. So that's not my favorite part. My favorite part is that it forces families to get together when they might not otherwise do that. And I have three grown sons, one in California, one in Pittsburgh, and one in Western Massachusetts. And so you have to work at bringing everybody together. And so far, Christmas has done that. Now, it's kind of, I wish we could celebrate Christmas at another time of the year, though, when travel wasn't so difficult. But, you know, that's not going to happen. So you put up with the travel, which is difficult because it's worth it. It's worth it to get everybody together at this time of year, I think.
When you were growing up, what were Christmases like?
My parents were immigrants from an island in the North Sea off of Germany and Denmark. And the tradition there is that Christmas Eve, you would go and get the tree and you would decorate it and have the presents the next morning. It was not like this, you know, two-week-long affair. And we lived in Jackson Heights, Queens, and my brothers and I would go down to the corner of Northern Boulevard, and there were trees being sold right outside the supermarket there. And we would get a tree, and we would pull it home and decorate it. And my brother would yell at me that I wasn't putting the tinsel on a strand at a time. and then we had, you know, a modest number of gifts the next morning. And as I got older, we would go to church. It was like a 10 o'clock service. I grew up in the Lutheran church, and so we would do that. And so that was... It was a couple of days. It wasn't the big buildup we see today, and of course we didn't have to travel anywhere. So those were good times.
The big talk certainly in Washington right now is the Republican tax plan. Now, from what I understand, Senator Rubio has said he will vote no, and now over the weekend, John McCain has left Washington, and he had said he would be a yes vote. But now he's gone. He won't be there for the vote. And if he comes back, when he comes back, hopefully, we hope him to come back, it's possible that there could be another Democratic vote with the election in Alabama last week. So what has happened to the tax plan? Now, what's going to happen?
Well, is that new news about Rubio? I thought he was a yes, because they gave him... some money that he wanted towards a refundable child care credit. And so he was a yes. Bob Corker, who was once so worried about the deficit, suddenly got over his worries about the deficit, and he's now a yes. And he's acting very insulted that people are suggesting there's a provision in the plan that benefits people with real estate holdings, which he would benefit financially from the bill, and they're suggesting that that had something to do with his changing his mind and not being so worried about the deficit. So I don't see any no votes anymore. So and John McCain kind of got a pass to go home. He's not well, obviously, and so that leaves him with 51 votes. And I don't think the election has been certified yet in Alabama. Roy Moore is still holding out. So I don't think Doug Jones will be seated until early next year when the Senate reconvenes. So I think they've got this wired. I think looks like it's happening.
So this will pass. How will it affect middle-income people, people listening to this program?
Virtually every economist has said that the benefits disproportionately go to people at the top, and they rationalize that saying, well, people at the top pay most of the taxes. Well, they pay most of the income taxes. Everybody else pays that payroll tax and the taxes you pay on things you have to buy in order to live. But if you're talking only about income taxes, you know, people who make more income pay more taxes, and so the Republican rationale is, therefore, they should get more back. Middle-income people, for the most part, will benefit only marginally, and some not at all. And if you live in a high-tax blue state like California, New Jersey, New York, you're likely to feel the pinch because they've capped how much you can deduct in property taxes and state and local taxes. So I don't think there's going to be much of a benefit for the middle class, certainly not one that warrants the president's over-the-top rhetoric about how this is just going to be the biggest, the best thing ever, and it's going to be so special, and it's going to create all these jobs. The concern is that the lowering of the corporate taxes, which, frankly, President Obama wanted also. I mean, I think that needed to be done. Did it need to go quite down to 21, as low as it's gone? Maybe not. But not many people think that that's going to result in corporations bringing back, you know, factories from overseas and bringing back jobs, and that they're going to be creating more jobs. It's likely going to be used to reward shareholders. So, you know, if you're at the top of the income bracket and you've got stocks in major corporations, you're probably going to do very well. But I think what we think of sort of ordinary middle-class people are going to see only a very marginal benefit. Now, they double the standard deduction, which people are going to like that. But if you were itemizing other deductions like state and local taxes or charitable deductions, you may not do that anymore. You may not get any further relief from that. So I think everybody's going to have to kind of do their own taxes and see how it comes out. And it's also not very simple. I mean, I think we still have a number of tax brackets and still a number of loopholes. And so I don't think the tax preparers are going to go out of business. You know, for a time, the Republicans were saying, oh, we want people to just fill out the back of an envelope. That's not the case.
What is the current state of Senator McCain? It just seems not very bleak, and that's sad, but boy, oh boy.
Well, he has an aggressive tumor. It's the same one that Senator Kennedy had, a glioblastoma, and he's done radiation, and he's done chemo, and I gather he was at Walter Reed last week because of the side effects from the chemo. You know, it's that tumor does not have a happy ending, let's put it that way. So he said he would come back if his vote were needed, so he's a firm yes. So they do have that in reserve, but I think it's a long plane trip to Arizona. He's back home now. And he's been such a fixture in Washington. You know, you love him one minute, you hate him the next. he's always spoken out, and you know, running as a maverick in 2004, and my goodness, and then running in tandem with Sarah Palin. I mean, there are just so many moments in this man's life. We're not even going into the fact that he was, you know, held in a cage for 5 years and came through that so heroically. No, he's a great American statesman, and it's hard to watch him have to go through this.
Absolutely. You talked about Jerry Brown's age and that he would not run. Vice President Biden has a big moment on The View last week where he consoles Meghan McCain. He's out on the book tour. He's not saying no when they ask him. Do you think
right? But he also says that he has not put any structure in place, at least not yet. If we see him start building a staff to aggressively run for president, then we'll know it's something different. I mean, I think right now, keeping that door open, it just adds to his currency as a public figure. And as a human being, I think he has long wanted the presidency, and I think he's reluctant to shut the door on that dream. You know, there's that joke that the only, once you've been bitten by the presidential bug, the only cure is embalming fluid. So he's not going to give up the dream until he absolutely has to. But if there were an election held today, I think he would win in a walk. I think he has a lot of appeal, certainly has experience, and could handle the office better than the person that we have there right now. But if you project forward to 2020 and you look at all of the people who have their eye on the presidency, it looks like it would be a very competitive primary. And I'm not sure that he would be the one who would come out on top.
Who right now, Republican and Democrat, are putting together staffs to make this run?
I don't know that anybody is putting together a staff, but I look at Jay Inslee, who's the governor of Washington State, who's now chairing the Democratic Governors Association, which was a position that Bill Clinton used to get better known nationally, and I think Governor Inslee has presidential ambition. And I look at Kirsten Gillibrand, New York senator, and how aggressive she has been on sexual harassment, beginning first in college campuses and in the military. I mean, she really forged policies in both those areas, and then came out very affirmatively about the need for Senator Franken to step down. And it was her stepping out on that issue that prompted a total of 10 female Democrats to take that position, and then a number of their male counterparts in the party took the position until 38 of the 48 Democrats in the caucus were telling Al Franken that he had to resign, including the leader, Schumer. Now, some of them are having some second thoughts here, but I think the fact that Kirsten Gillibrand was so out front on that leads most of us to think that that's part of her her presidential ambition. There are a lot of women senators who are Democrats who were eyeing the 2020 race too, and to her to grab hold of that issue is seen as her getting a good jockeying position in the lead up to 2020. So those are two I can think off the top of my head who seem to be putting the pieces in place. And I think Kamala Harris, everyone expects her to be running for president. She's very, very careful not to get ahead of her skis, as they say. I mean, she's by being very low-key, she's encouraged, not deliberately, but she's encouraged speculation that she's doing that because she wants to be seen as a, you know, hardworking senator by 2020, not someone who tried to grab the spotlight too soon.
There is a lot of talk this morning about people wanting Al Franken to reconsider, Senator Franken. Do you think there's any chance of that?
I would never say never, but the governor has now announced his successor, and she has said that she plans to run for 2020. So I think it would be super awkward. He'd have to really be sure that he had his caucus behind him. It's not enough to have just Senator Manchin saying publicly, I wish he wouldn't step down, and then one or two other senators reportedly telling Franken that they regretted what they said, and they regretted joining the sort of the group urging him out. But one of those senators, I guess Senator Leahy, I don't know that he's gone public himself, but other people have sort of said he's one of the senators expressing regrets. And then there's another one who's quoted anonymously. So that's like three. So it would have to really be a stampede, I think, for Franken to be able to stay, given the fact that his successor has already been announced.
Last week after the election in Alabama, USA Today came out with an editorial, and they're not particularly known for their political editorials, and I want to read a little bit of this because I thought it was interesting. A president who would all but call Senator Gillibrand a prostitute is not fit to clean the toilets in the Barack Obama Presidential Library or to shine the shoes of George W. Bush. This isn't about the policy differences we have with all presidents or our disappointment in some of their decisions. Obama and Bush both failed in many ways. They broke promises and they told untruths. But the basic decency of each man was never in doubt. The nation doesn't seek nor expect perfect presidents, and some have certainly been deeply flawed. But a president who so shows such disrespect for the truth, for ethics, for the basic duties of the job, and the decency toward others fails at the very essence of what has always made America great. Now, this was prompted by a tweet last week from President Trump, in which he said lightweight Senator Gillibrand, a total flunky for Chuck Schumer, and someone who would come to my office begging for campaign contributions not so long ago and would do anything for them, is now in the ring fighting against Trump, very disloyal to Bill and crooked. What'd you make of that editorial, Eleanor?
Well, Trump has been saying for a long time that politicians will do anything if you give them money. And I wish he would, report chapter and verse of what he's asked these politicians to do and whether they've actually delivered on it. I mean, campaign contributions in excess have really distorted our political system. And, I think, Trump won in part because he blew the whistle on all of that. Now, the way he responded in that tweet, he also knew that he was issuing at a time when sexual harassment and predation was in the center of the news. So I'm sure he realized that he would be taken to task for that, the way he worded that. And I agree with the editorial that he has debased the presidency. It's presidency is not only about grace and dignity, it is also about the policies that you follow. And George W. Bush did wage war and invade Iraq in a way that has caused lasting damage to our geopolitics and ended far too many lives and created a lot of disruption. And so that should be kind of the number one policy thing that he has to be remembered for. But I must say that his kind of sense of humor and the way he has kind of stayed out of politics since has made a lot of American people look at him a lot more kindly than they did when he left office, when his poll ratings were only in the 30s, which is where Donald Trump is today, by the way, in the low 30s, 32-33%. So we've got a dangerously unpopular president this early in his term. And in Washington, people are really on edge, worrying and wondering what he might do to try to restore his popularity or to try to end the Russia probe. He's so unpredictable. And again, that's a quality that's, again, even more dangerous than the crudity of some of his tweets.
The Russia probe continues. I believe President Trump's lawyers are meeting with Mueller this week. The president has released some tweets, I think, that he thinks he will be exonerated at this point. What are you hearing about the Mueller investigation?
Well, if you listen to the lawyers around Trump and what they're telling Trump, I mean, they suggest that this is going to be wrapped up early in the new year, and that there's no evidence of, you know, criminal collusion. If you talk to people who were connected to the Mueller probe, he's got a lot of attorneys working on this. They seem to be looking at financial transactions that predate the time when Trump went to the White House. And it seems a lot more open-ended than the Trump lawyers are telling the president. So Mueller's been very good. He doesn't leak. So I think everybody is going on sort of guesswork and trying to read the tea leaves. But I think it's possible this could be wrapped up somewhat early in the new year, maybe by spring. I mean, I don't see Mueller as another Ken Starr, who was the special counsel during Clinton, who had a multi-year investigation. I think Mueller seems pretty dogged and determined, though, to wrap this up as efficiently and as quickly as he can.
Do you feel at this particular point that it will have catastrophic repercussions for the president?
I think it would be more catastrophic for the president if he tried to fire the deputy attorney general who's overseeing the investigation, Mr. Rosenstein, and or if he tried to find a way to get rid of Bob Mueller. I think that would trigger impeachment, and I think that would end catastrophically, and I'm sure the president probably is flirting with that because he would just like to get this thing, you know, out of his hair. But otherwise, I think Mueller has three choices. He can exonerate the president and say there is no criminal collusion, and he can decide not to make a case out of financial misdeeds that occurred before Trump became president, or he could decide to bring an indictment against the president, which would be testing the constitutionality of that. I think most people think you can't do that against a sitting president, but there are some constitutional scholars who say you could, so he might want to test that. And then the third alternative is to just make his case to the House of Representatives and let them decide whether they want to file articles of impeachment. And then you would need a majority vote to proceed on articles of impeachment, which you're not going to get if the Republicans are still in charge of the House. So that may have to wait until the 2018 elections, and if the Democrats are able to secure the 2024 seats they need to regain the majority. So those are the three routes. The only other route is the 25th Amendment that would take the vice president and half the cabinet to basically stand up and say that Donald Trump is not capable of carrying out his duties. And I don't see that happening as a result of what Mueller comes up with. Maybe Trump's reaction to what Mueller comes up with could trigger the 25th Amendment. I think that's not out of the question.
What I don't understand is what we know about the Mueller investigation right now is that Manafort was indicted, Papadopoulos took a plea agreement, and we think wore a wire, possibly. He's working for Mueller, worked for Mueller. Flynn pled guilty and took a plea agreement to work for Mueller. Now, if all these plea agreements are being given, there must
well,
be...
Well, all these, two.
Two, well, these two. These two are being
okay,
given.
Right.
Who is the person? Why do they need their cooperation? Who is higher than they?
Flynn is higher in the three, four cases that have been brought forward, because Paul Manafort's deputy, Mr. Gates, also was indicted. Manafort chaired the campaign for a period of time, and he did probably have financial dealings with Trump or Trump associates before the campaign and probably going on into the transition. I think Flynn was the national security advisor, maybe only for a week, but he was, and he traveled the country with candidate Trump, and he would lead the cry at rallies to, put Hillary Clinton in jail. So he was around the president through all of the time when a lot of these contacts were made with the Russians. And he's the one that President Trump tried to urge the then FBI Director James Comey to go light on or let him off. So the president seems to want to shield Flynn, and maybe it's just out of his loyalty to Flynn, but the question is, does Flynn have information that can lead, if not to the president, but to the president's son or son-in-law? I think those are the two people who are in legal jeopardy before you get to the president.
Two things puzzle me about this. Papadopoulos, the time he would have been wearing the wire, if he did, which we don't know for sure, but would have been up through October. Now, Flynn would not have been there during that time, because I think it was January through October is when this all went down, when the deal was struck with Mueller. So the Flynn plea and guilty, that doesn't seem to tie into Papadopoulos. And Flynn saying that the transition team are the ones who ordered him to do this, but we don't know who that was. If the president, let's say it's not the president, let's say it's Pence, let's say it's Kushner, let's say it's his son, Trump Jr., if he pardons any of them, if he pardons Flynn, is there an outcry for impeachment?
I think if he pardoned Flynn or fired Mueller, that would add to the obstruction of justice case that's building against the president. Also, if he pardoned Flynn, that would just be for the crime of lying to the FBI. And I think Flynn would then surrender his Fifth Amendment rights on other issues. So I think it's problematical for the president to fire Flynn. I'm not that well versed on all the legalities here, but pardoning Flynn is not risk free, and I'm sure the president is weighing that. Now, he was asked about Flynn last week, and he said, it's not time to talk about that yet. But that was interesting way to respond. So I'm sure that's on the table, but right now I think it would do more damage to the president's standing than it would help.
When I look at this thing, it seems like this week something big might happen, because Trump's lawyer is meeting with Mueller, and if the report comes back bad, wouldn't the best time to fire somebody be this time of year when news people are on vacation, Christmas and New Year's is going on, to try to deflect away from it somewhat?
Every news organization has got a plan in place should that happen. I think everyone is very aware that this is when this president might do it, even though just yesterday he said that there's no plan to fire Mueller. I'm sure there are advanced stories written. I think people have been told that they're on call, or some people are remaining in place. Washington is very much on tender hooks, thinking that this, if it's going to happen, then now's the time. So, there's no way he could do that and have it slip through the headlines and have nobody notice. Everybody's sitting there waiting with their fingers ready to start tapping on the computer to send out the story. And I don't know what television has done, but, they can put together a bunch of clips very, very easily. And the analogy to Watergate would be irresistible. And I have noticed that in the last couple of days, the president's defenders are starting to say in unison that this is worse than Watergate, and which is what Democrats have been saying. So I'm trying to figure out what they mean by it and why they've adopted that cry. I guess they're saying that the government is millions and millions of dollars they're throwing more at this than they did at Watergate, and maybe Trump's defenders were all defenders too. That's a story that I'm actually working on this week.
Maybe this is the way to word this question. The news organizations, I'm sure, are ready for this story, but if it happens Thursday, Friday, and the news organizations get it out, are John Q. Public and Jane Q. Public going to care as they're going to grandma's house and traveling, and all federal agencies are shut down, two big holidays? By the time they come back, will it be less of a story?
They're going to care because the president's defenders are going to basically call this the liberals and the elites and the Democrats are trying to nullify the voice of the electorate. And I think, the coverage will be immediate, and then the response from Trump's defenders will be out there. And I think even if you're at grandma's, that's going to be the subject of conversation around the table. It would be huge. Now, the Saturday Night Massacre, which happened during the Nixon administration, Watergate was rolling along as a scandal, but it wasn't a full-blown scandal until that happened. And then that's what triggered the hearings in the House. And if Elizabeth Holtzman, who was on the House impeachment hearing, said that the House switchboard crashed. They got tons of mail, faxes. This is before, obviously, social media. That really woke up the public. So I think even if they try to slip this in over the holidays, it's such a big explosion that the fallout will easily continue into the new year.
Certainly. You hate to speculate on something like this, but his lawyer is meeting with Mueller. We now know that Papadopoulos was cooperating in some way with Mueller. We now know Flynn is cooperating with Mueller. Boy, is there much chance this report doesn't come back bad to Trump's lawyer and that there isn't a firing? I mean, I kind of lead toward 65% that Mueller might be fired by the end of the week.
Well, I think the president buys himself a bigger world of woe if he fires Mueller. So I think his lawyers are trying to prevent that. But, you know, we are dealing with a president who has great confidence in his gut instincts. And if he wants to go ahead and he's prodded by, you know, Steve Bannon, I'm assuming Steve Bannon would like to see him fire Mueller. And Bannon, even though he's been ostracized, still talks to the president now and then. So we don't know. All we can do is be prepared for whatever happens and prepared to deal with the fallout. But the Republicans in Congress are moving with great urgency to get their tax bill before anything further develops. They're keenly aware that this president might not have much political capital in, you know, in a month or 3 months or 6 months, so they want to act now, and they're pushing to get all of the judges in place. Last week they confirmed 3 circuit judges. They have confirmed 12 for the entire year. Barack Obama confirmed 3 his first year, and he had a Democratic Senate. So they're really pushing, I would think it's fair to say, to stack the courts with, people conservative ideology.
I just found over the weekend and last week the stories questioning Mueller's and his team's ability to be unbiased. I found those stories interesting. I certainly don't think the president would come out and say, I'm firing him because of the meeting of my lawyer and he. But I think these stories that his people are biased and he's biased, I think that would be the story he would use. That's kind of laying in the weeds there. But it's fascinating to see what will happen.
Oh, no, it's a concerted effort to undermine the Mueller probe as a biased witch hunt against the president, and also saying, you know, the FBI didn't do its duty, they didn't really put Hillary Clinton in jail, and they should have, and look at all these people who, you know, gave her money, and look at the emails between people on the investigation and how they don't like Trump. Oh, he can cherry pick a number of instances, and in a world where people only listen to the media that they agree with, I mean, that story is being pushed relentlessly on Fox News and in the right-wing media, that the FBI is just falling apart and it's terrible and it's all biased against the president. And Steve Bannon uses the phrase nullification project. He's telling President Trump's supporters that these are the elites and the Democrats who are trying to silence your voice. So yeah, this is a very active marketing scheme that's going on, orchestrated among the White House and Republican outlets to discredit Mueller should the worst happen.
I think an underlying story, and maybe this is where we'll spend the end of our time here, has been voting machines. Because the bottom line has always been nobody hacked into voting machines, nobody changed a vote. And I keep seeing stories popping up since about June from respectable news sites that say that if the Russians did that, that it would not be so easy to detect, because obviously they would want to do it undercover, that this is one thing that Mueller is investigating. And even in Hillary Clinton's book, which I just finished reading, What Happened, she says there's no evidence of people hacking into voting machines yet. I don't know.
Well, yeah, I think the missing link there is the Russians clearly were attempting, and there were attempts in a number of places around the country. Now, did the Trump Big Data campaign, which was overseen by Jared Kushner, did they give the Russians any hints about what localities they might want to see if they could hack into. Was there any collusion there on where the votes are and how you might interact with voting machines? That's what they are definitely looking at that. So, and we do know that there were attempts made in a number of localities, and various areas were actually warned, but nobody came up with any evidence that anything had actually happened.
If that final question here before we break, if that would happen, because there is just a lot of strange stuff that happened on that election night when polling data is supposed to be so great. And I mean, I think we all knew that Trump was going to win Ohio. He had always led here, but the Pennsylvania lead had Hillary ahead by 11 points. And Michigan was so slim, and Wisconsin had her way ahead. Would the country stand if they found out that voting machines were hacked into? Because that seems to be people's Waterloo. Would people stand for an election that was settled that way?
Well, we don't really have a mechanism to undo an election that we conclude wasn't fairly conducted. Again, impeachment is the only recourse. And Donald Trump is so sensitive to any suggestion that he didn't win the landslide that he believes he won. And he did win significantly in the Electoral College. But, I mean, if evidence like that came up, it would force a reckoning with how we vote everywhere. And voting is mainly controlled by localities, and there are vast differences between localities. And some, you know, don't have paper ballots anymore. Some don't have any backup. And the Trump administration has done nothing to fund efforts to really secure and stabilize our voting system. You're dealing with a lot of ifs here. If true evidence came up, I'm sure it would be disputed, first of all. But the bottom line is that our voting system is vulnerable, and we really need to take a nonpartisan look at it.
The only thing I can say in parting is something I've never understood: is at the last debate and through the end of the election, one thing Donald Trump kept saying was, "I don't know if I am going to accept the results of the election." And then even after he won, he kept questioning it, kept questioning where votes were, of course, in his favor, but kept to this day, still voter fraud. Now, why? I could never understand, you won. Why are you questioning that? It's strange.
Well, he's got a commission on voter fraud, which is headed by Chris Kobach, Kansas, I think he's Kansas AG, who's one of the few people who believe that they're, quote, massive, like the president is claiming, that 2 or 3 million people voted for Hillary wrongly or they were illegal immigrants. And that commission, I think it's met once. It hasn't produced any evidence. To me, that would be the definition of fake news, where you gin up an idea and you put it out there and you don't find any evidence, but you keep ginning up the idea. I mean, that's what they're doing, and I think a lot of probably Trump's really stalwart supporters, you know, still believe that there was voter fraud or Donald Trump would have won in the popular vote as well.
Should be an interesting week. Eleanor, it's always a pleasure to have you on. Merry Christmas. Happy holidays.
Right. Same to you. Absolutely.
And take care. And I hope
your listeners.
I hope you have a, okay. Hope you have a safe trip. Bye-bye.
Thank you so much. Okay. Bye-bye.
Eleanor Clift. We're going to take a break. Come back with Rusty Warren after the break.
Those big fat people, they have to knock walls down to haul you out with a forklift and take you to the meatpacking plant.